mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, last week, the Center to Advance Manufacturing held a roundtable with legislators, industry leaders, and educators. Executive Director Tim Miley shares the idea behind the event and a review of what was discussed. Also this morning, our conversation with Findlay Mayor Christina Mern from the U.S. Conference of Mayors annual meeting, which happened over the weekend in Kansas City. And like Memorial Day, the upcoming 4th of July week is expected to be one of record-setting travel. This year's WAVE Awards honor the best of the best in the tourism and vacation industry. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Monday, June 24th, 2024. Big news. The leader of a marijuana dispensary firm, Story Cannabis, which they actually have locations all over the country in states where cannabis is legal. They have three locations in Ohio, and the CEO of Story Cannabis, Jason Vedati, I think is how you pronounce it, says that recreational sales in the state of Ohio could be getting started this week. Could be getting... Now, the story does not say who he heard that from. Mr. Vedati says he has been told that adult recreational sales are rolling out by Friday. It doesn't say who told him that, but state officials have previously said that the goal was to have some dispensaries selling to the general public before Independence Day. Apparently, this is very important to get this... marijuana, recreational marijuana into the hands of Ohioans before the 4th of July, because nothing goes together like intoxicating substances and fireworks. So we gotta make sure that we get recreational marijuana rolled out in the state of Ohio just in time to set off those explosives, because that's very important. The state's Department of Commerce opened up dual-use license applications for existing medical marijuana dispensaries earlier this month, and the head of Ohio's Division of Cannabis Control has said that by the 4th of July, they should have this rolled out. And according to this guy, anyway, it may be by the end of this week. So the 4th of July, right around the corner. So that big news here. Elsewhere, some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories. To get your Monday morning started, welcome to a new week, by the way, the World Health Organization and Eli Lilly Company have issued a warning to consumers regarding fake versions of those weight loss drugs like Ozempic, Wegovy. You know, those have become very, very popular. And whenever anything becomes very, very popular, scam artists will flood in to try and take advantage. They say fake drugs have been found in several countries around the world, often advertised and sold online through social media or even at certain med spas. In an open letter, Eli Lilly Company, makers of Ozempic, said these fakes may contain no medicine, the wrong medicine, incorrect dosages of medicine, or multiple medicines mixed together, all of which could result in serious harm. The World Health Organization recommends using only prescriptions from licensed physicians and avoid buying the drugs from unfamiliar sources. So just word to the wise, I know these things are very popular, and I know they are very expensive, not always covered by insurance. So it can be tempting to go someplace other than your doctor or a licensed pharmacist, but it is quite dangerous to do so. So that warning being issued. This, I thought, was kind of interesting on the newswire this morning. And if you really think about it, it is logical. It is not unfamiliar advice. If you want your kid to put down their phone... And I know in the summertime, this is always a concern. You know, the kids spending too much time on their screens. You want to get them out, get them active, go outside and play. It's nice weather. It's summertime. Why waste all your time on your phone? But if you want your kid to put down their phone, you, mom and dad, gonna have to do it first. According to data collected from 10,000 American parents and their early teen and preteen children, specifically ages 12, 13, that's where the parents of 12 and 13-year-olds. According to the data collected from 10,000 American parents and their 12 and 13-year-old children, kids will parrot their parents' phone usage. One of the biggest predictors of adolescent screen use is their parents' screen use. And again, this is not shocking or groundbreaking. We see this in any kind of behavior in our kids. It is learned behavior from the parents. The survey also found that more than one-third of families watch screens during meals, and half of kids have phone access in bed. They suggest that banning phones at bedtime could help reduce screen time the most. If you choose only one rule to implement, according to Jason Nagata, child psychologist and lead author of this study, if you can choose only one rule to implement, cutting off kids' access to phone at bedtime may be the most effective one for reducing total screen time. Just leave the phone outside the bedroom so they're not even tempted. Speaking of phones, we do an awful lot of our shopping online these days, but do you still get excited when you've got a package coming? I've got a package coming that I ordered from Amazon, and it's coming today, and I'm all giddy about this. I'm all excited, but I'm also, you know, even still, we've done this for how many years we've been buying things online. I still get excited when I know that there's a package coming for me. And, but I'm a little apprehensive as well. I'm a little nervous because I'm not really sure if I'm actually going to like this thing that I have bought. I think I am, but I haven't been able to see it or touch it or hold it or, you know, test it out or anything like that because I haven't physically seen the product. I've seen pictures, I've read the reviews, but I haven't actually seen it. But we do this. We buy these things online with the expectation that if we don't like what we have purchased, we can just send it back, right? We can just get a refund. And what happens, and I think a lot of us have done this, what happens if we buy something online and later find out that the company who sold it to us will not take it back? I think sometimes we will dispute the charge with our credit card company, right? Because the product that we got was not as advertised or it was not what it was what we were expecting. Well, merchants in the U.S. Are reporting a 70% increase in chargebacks in 2023. Disputes over credit card charges are surging as shoppers learn how easy it is to get your money back. Consumers disputed over 100 million credit card charges last year, worth an estimated $11 billion. When cardholders file a dispute, the card companies often give them a temporary credit for the amount in question while they investigate the claim. And then they pull those funds from the merchant's account. Card companies streamlined the dispute process early in the pandemic to help customers who wanted money back for canceled, you know, subscription plans and things like that. Before then, customers had to call their credit card company to file a dispute and document their claims. Now, disputing a charge is as simple as clicking a couple of buttons on an app. And so they say that there's a lot of misuse in those 100 million credit card disputes, worth an estimated $11 billion. Industry is still struggling with this, but I'm not surprised by this necessarily. I mean, as much shopping as we do online, number one, and number two, the fact that we are quickly becoming a cashless society, even when we're shopping in person, we don't pay cash for things anymore. We use our cards. So the more we use our cards, the more likely we are to occasionally dispute those charges. Have you ever done that? Ever disputed a charge? If so, you are part of the problem. I know I have. I actually have done that. I will admit I have done that. I've never, you know, then there are the people who will dispute the charges simply because they can dispute the charge and get what they ordered for free, right? They're being dishonest because they think they can get out of paying. I've never done that, obviously, but, you know, that is an issue. And I think that's what they are worried that some people are doing. Clearly, some people are doing to what extent that is an issue is probably a matter of dispute, but kind of interesting nonetheless. And how about this? Lastly, this morning, among the first things you need to know, and this is definitely, you would put this under the category of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Did you know that the bald eagle, even though it is a part of the Great Seal of the United States and has been almost from the very beginning of the country, and even though it is a symbol, a universally recognized symbol of the United States, the bald eagle is not America's national bird. It has never been so designated. I know, I was surprised to find that out too. Now, however, there is a push to name it America's national bird, officially, the bald eagle. Several lawmakers in Minnesota have introduced a bipartisan bill to give the bald eagle the title of America's national bird. Amy Klobuchar and Tina Smith, both Democrats, are working with Wyoming Republican Senator Cynthia Lummis to push a bill through the Senate. A companion bill has also been introduced in the House of Representatives, being supported by all 8 Minnesota representatives. Why this started with the delegation from Minnesota, I don't know, but I think it's long overdue, and I think if you are looking for something that all Americans, regardless of your political affiliation or your, you know, whatever, you know, religion, race, religion, political affiliation, whatever, all Americans could agree on, is that the bald eagle should be America's national bird. I think most of us thought it already was, but no. But hopefully, before long, it will be. That's long overdue. There you go. Some of the most interesting. That blew me away when I saw that on the news. I actually had to look that up and confirm that with like multiple other sources reporting the same thing. So, nah, really? The bald eagle is not America's national bird? How can that possibly be? But it is. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Monday morning started.
I'm Jay Fox on the Ohio News Network. This weekend, the CenterPoint Energy Dayton Air Show delighted thousands of fans despite record heat, which sent roughly 100 people to medical tents for heat-related treatment. This was the 50th anniversary show, which featured the Golden Knights parachute team and the Blue Angels. 10 men between the ages of 16 and 27 were victims of a mass shooting in the Short North area of Columbus this weekend. There were no fatalities. Colin Dorsey from ONN affiliate WBN NSTV has comments from city leaders.
Mayor Andrew Genther saying, quote, "The gun violence that occurred early this morning in the Short North is outrageous. It's unacceptable and it must stop." He also calls on state lawmakers saying, quote, "We need the state and federal governments to step up to keep guns off the streets and out of the hands of violent criminals. If they don't have the courage to do it, then they need to get out of our way and let us act. Our community demands and deserves better." City Attorney Zach Klein also saying, "We cannot sit back or become none to the presence of violence in our city."
After East Palestine, Norfolk Southern is making changes. Lena Lai with ONN affiliate WKYC-TV in Cleveland explains.
It is planning to lead a new effort to improve the way vent and control decisions are made. So this comes ahead of an NTSB hearing to explain why the controlled burn after last year's toxic train derailment was wrong.
For the Ohio News Network, I'm Jay Fox.
So now our cover story this morning. Last week, the Center to Advance Manufacturing held a roundtable with legislators, industry leaders, and educators And Executive Director Tim Miley is with us this morning to talk more about the idea behind that event and talk a little bit about what was discussed at the event. Tim, thanks very much for taking the time. First of all, we appreciate it.
Hey, Chris, thanks. It's good to be back with you.
So for the benefit of those who are not real familiar, talk a little bit about the mission of the Center to Advance Manufacturing. Obviously, still relatively new. It is a collaboration between the University of Findlay, Owens Community College, and Bowling Green State University. Talk a little bit about the mission and what you do.
Sure. And that's somewhat how we started the meeting last week, as well as remind everybody why we're all in the room. As I'm driving up and down I-75 right now, as we talk, we have a lot of manufacturers in northwestern Ohio, and they're all being challenged with a lot of different things right now related to cost and workforce and automation and new policies being put in place. And the three presidents of the three universities realized in 2021 is they have a lot to offer industry in northwestern Ohio. And then collectively together, it's not one plus one equals three. It's exponential of what they can offer. So what we do every day at the center is take the assets of higher education that can be faculty and staff that are researchers, that can be students that are training or graduating. It could be lab equipment. And we bring that as a package deal to industry every single day to the manufacturers of northwestern Ohio.
So this roundtable discussion was held at the University of Findlay. What was discussed? Kind of give us the outline of the agenda and some of the topics that were discussed amongst, as we mentioned, not only educators, industry leaders, and legislators in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, and I'll just add in there, too, a lot of economic development leaders. We had Jobs Ohio, RGP, local economic developers, Ohio Department of Development, Ohio Manufacturers Association. So we truly had everybody in the room. And it was really a two-part meeting. First, I gave a quick update on the center on some of the projects that we've completed, because if you remember, we are funded by the state legislature. So I took an opportunity to give a little bit of a report out on some of the projects we've completed and some of the projects we have coming up. And then we really got into a listening session where I facilitated, where my goal of the whole meeting was to hear what's on their mind and what can we put in place. So, of course, workforce came up, energy, infrastructure, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, lots of good conversations. And we take that information and back and figure out, okay, now we've heard what's challenging them. How do we start to drive solutions with all the stakeholders?
Well, that was going to be my next question. How do you then prioritize those issues that were brought up at the meeting? And certainly the ideas you mentioned of bringing everyone, getting everyone together in the same room to discuss these issues, that's one thing. How do you prioritize then what you focus on moving forward?
So we do a couple of different ways. We have ongoing conversations throughout the year with manufacturers, so nothing that we heard was necessarily new, but sometimes it's useful to get everybody together to see what others are doing as well. We had opportunities for them to provide feedback in written format during the meeting, so we're going to have to sift through all of the data. But you know, the key ones that really came out, workforce, no surprise at all, but workforce isn't always the technical skills they're looking for. It's talking about the ability to solve problems. We had Honda at the meeting, for example, and they were talking about the engineers that they'd like to hire and how they need to be problem solvers and not just always on the technical side. So we'll go through that. Energy really surprised me of how much we discussed energy with everything and the capacity for energy into the future. And then the technology, there was a symposium the other day at the University of Findlay that I attended about artificial intelligence, and manufacturers are really trying to figure out how to integrate that. And they feel strongly that higher education can put together training. And Chris, this is things that maybe we don't even think about with artificial intelligence, of utilizing it to sift through their emails. And
yeah,
you know, you have managers who are busy every day, and it's all about augmenting your day and making it more efficient.
I was going to bring that up. You mentioned the AI symposium that was also held last week. And I was going to mention that as an example of some of what you do in addition to, again, these conversations with the stakeholders, but as an example of the way you put that information or that those needs of the stakeholders into practice. Talk a little bit about that symposium.
Yeah, so the symposium was held at the University of Finland, and it started off where they brought everybody together, and it was a group of around, I would say, 75 individuals or so. And it started off with baselining artificial intelligence, the do's and the don'ts. Don't necessarily be scared of it, but make sure you know how to use the prompts of working through with all that. And then we broke off in sections. So I went into, for example, one that Ohio Logistics and Goodyear Tire was talking about, how they utilize AI, one, in their manufacturing process, in their day-to-day activities. And then Ohio Logistics was talking about how they use it every single day to manage their floor space and their pallet inventory. At our event last week, one of the manufacturers was talking about they're using artificial intelligence now. They're taking their data, their production data, their workforce data over the past few years, and they're now using this for a predictable analysis over the next 3 years. How many people are they going to need? When do they need to do preventive maintenance? When do they need to purchase certain supplies relative to their supply chain? So there's lots of different people integrating this, but it provides a lot of challenges and a steep learning curve because you can't just jump into it and expect artificial intelligence to be beneficial. You really got to have a good plan to make it work for your facility.
Well, and I think that's such a good point because there are so many stories that we hear in the news about AI this, AI that, AI being integrated into our computer and our phone operating systems and so on. It's a lot of, I guess, high level, big picture stories, but then boiling this down to the way it actually impacts local individual businesses, large and small, and the ways that they can benefit from it and the things they have to watch out for with it.
Yeah, there's no doubt. So you think about connectivity and the protection of your data and how are you handling that.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to be making all your decisions just based on what the AI said. What they were talking about is let it get you 85% of the way.
Yeah.
And then let the human finish the last 15%. Let that front end stuff let you help you out. But yeah, we continue to work today. A lot of people call it Industry 4.0 or the digitization of manufacturing, where you take your PLCs and take that data and turn it into actionable items. So how much energy per part are you using? And how do you find that sweet spot to make sure you're using energy at the right time during the day?
Yeah.
There's so much data that happens. You can use that for how much downtime do you have? How much downtime was downtime you expected versus didn't expect?
Yeah.
And, you know, all this is
well, and it's
manufacturing. They're splitting pennies.
Yeah. And it's really interesting that there are so many intersections of all of these issues. As you mentioned, workforce, labor, energy come up in the roundtable. And here, all of that sort of intersects with AI at the symposium that also was held last week. Also, want to ask you about this since you're yep. actually on the road with us right now. We have the story last week that the Ohio Department of Transportation is looking at improving the traffic flow along U.S. 23 north of Columbus, which I know is big news for anyone who travels from our area, Northwest Ohio, into Central Ohio. That was big news. But also there was a story associated with that, and we were reporting on it last week, that the Department of Transportation continues to look at the possibility of opening up a more direct freeway connecting Toledo and Columbus. How closely are you watching things like that? I mean, obviously, a direct route going from Toledo to Columbus would be a big deal, but it also would potentially impact economic development along the corridor that includes Findlay and Hancock County because of the way you move from Toledo to Columbus today. How closely do you watch things of this nature from an economic development standpoint?
But so very closely for two reasons. One, logistics and supply chain. If you don't have healthy roadways to move products, you're not going to have healthy economic development.
Mm-hmm.
But two, I also, Governor DeWine appointed me on the Transportation Review Advisory Council. So I'm one of nine people in the state of Ohio who sit on the Ohio Department of Transportation's board who oversees major infrastructure. So I'm actually involved in quite a few of those projects. And it's a complicated issue on 23 because you have home rule. So you have local entities who have put in a lot of this infrastructure, the stoplights, the intersections.
Yeah.
So the state just can't come in and wipe them out. And of course, it's extremely expensive to handle all this. And if you just take a look at the original engineering, the right of way, the detailed design, I mean, you think about County Road 99 and 75, which is one intersection in Findlay.
Mm-hmm.
And we started talking about that 7 years ago. Now we're talking about a corridor from central Ohio to northwestern Ohio. But they continue to plug away at it. If you look at 15 going down through Wyandotte County and Hancock County, a lot of those intersections are being closed off. But they're really getting down to the complicated areas down near north of Delaware,
right,
and down toward Columbus. So it is, the governor is obviously committed in working through this. I know Director Marchbanks is committed, but there's no easy answer, but they are taking the appropriate steps. But, you know, back to the first point of why I watch it is we have to have connectivity.
Yeah.
And I know there's pain points with construction here and there, but it's certainly all worth that these investments pay off, because when companies are looking to site a facility somewhere, they look at their proximity to the customers and their workforce and their suppliers. And that proximity can be expanded if you have a good road network, and which is what Northwest Ohio is blessed with. But I know that's going to continue to be a point for a long time. Of how do we reduce that amount of time from, whether they talk about 47 stoplights or so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you mentioned the cost, and I kind of joked last week that I would gladly pay $2 billion to eliminate all of those traffic lights when I drive 23 into Columbus. Anyone who's ever made that drive knows how big of a pain that is. Again,
I get down there frequently. I understand.
Tim Miley is Executive Director of the Center to Advanced Manufacturing. We've got a link up on our webpage for more information about what they do and what they have been involved in of late. Tim, thanks very much for the update. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Over the weekend, the U.S. Conference of Mayors held their annual meeting in Kansas City. And of course, Findlay Mayor Christina Mern is a member of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, who was there for a very busy weekend of meetings and forums and seminars and so on and so forth. On Friday, as the Conference of Mayors annual meeting was getting underway, we spoke with Mayor Mern about that event and what she would be doing through the course of the weekend. So for those who don't know, you are among roughly two dozen of the more than 200 mayors at the annual meeting who serve on the advisory board for the Conference of Mayors. What is your role as a member of the advisory board, and does that carry with it any special duties or responsibilities at the annual meeting?
Yeah, it does hold a little more responsibility. So the trustees is kind of the level up, and that organization is kind of the governing board of the conference. The advisory board is exactly that. It's the individuals that are typically serving as a kind of a leadership member on our standing committees. We typically are invited to participate in different events throughout the year, kind of representing the organization. We also are a little more responsible in helping welcome our new mayors and show them the ropes. And then typically we also are asked to speak on kind of different best practices and things going on in our community as well.
So will you be speaking then to some of your contemporaries, and what will you be talking about?
Yeah, so I did already speak about some of the workforce development programs that we are doing in Findlay and Hancock County, how we have structured the workforce coalition through Raise the Bar of Hancock County, and how we continue to see that as a great opportunity to help promote economic mobility. And as was announced back in January, the city of Findlay received a DollarWise grant through Bank of America. And so I was talking a little bit about that program and how we are looking forward to implementing it to really help individuals that have previously been incarcerated or have had previously had a record, be mm-hmm. able to get jobs and help, you know, continue to better their lives.
So not giving away all of the secrets of the Findlay formula necessarily.
No, not at all, but definitely looking for ways to help other my colleagues improve their communities as well. But Findlay's still on the front lines and very special. And one of the other topics that definitely hasn't been super glamorous, but that I continue to be really involved in is PFAS and PFOAs, or kind of known as those forever chemicals. And the EPA has been releasing a bunch of new rules and regulations that have the potential to cost communities millions and millions of dollars as we look to decrease the amount of those in water. And certainly, I agree, we don't want them in our drinking water at certain levels. But in my opinion, the EPA is taking very drastic steps that are going to be nearly unachievable and definitely not financially possible for many communities to comply with. So really working to talk to the EPA and other communities and try to advocate for some resolutions for the U.S. Conference of Mayors to support to kind of push back on the current administration's approach.
As you're kind of alluding to, as always, there are a wide range of issues to be discussed at the meeting on everything from infrastructure to homelessness to technology. Obviously, there is no way one person can attend all of those breakout sessions on every issue. What are the ones that are of the highest priority for you?
Yeah, so for example, my schedule yesterday started off speaking at the DollarWise grant program. The next hour was part of the plenary session talking about mental health. That was the topic for that. Then talking about unfunded mandates and kind of federal advocacy for funds to support local programs and water regulations. And then I serve on the Energy Standing Committee. So talking about energy policy, things communities can be doing to make their communities more energy efficient, as well as then programs around election integrity and community safety. So that was just yesterday. That was part of my schedule yesterday.
They keep you busy.
We're a day and a half in and I am pretty tired already, but I'll get a second wind and chug some vitamin C and coffee and be good to go.
a number of administration officials often make it a point to be at the Conference of Mayors annual meeting as well. Are there any in particular that you are most interested in either hearing from and or providing feedback to?
Yeah, so I actually just was speaking to some representatives from the Department of Transportation talking about infrastructure projects in our community, as well as some potential programs that they are looking to roll out to communities, providing feedback on the positives I see in the programs, as well as concerns I have. So, you know, being able to talk to them, help them share some of the projects that are going on in our community, whether it's flood mitigation, water and sewer infrastructure, road and bridge infrastructure. Having conversation with federal administrative officials is really beneficial because it builds relationships, but it also gives me a lot of opportunity to share how I would see those programs impacting our communities and hopefully help shape the policies that they decide to move forward with.
And expanding on that a bit, obviously, this is a presidential election year, of course, and part of the annual meeting is to adopt policy resolutions that guide the advocacy agenda of the conference. What would your priorities be for that agenda?
Yeah, so when I have the opportunity, or if I was, talking to the president, I would say that the priorities that I see obviously are border security, immigration reform, financial policies to ensure our economy continues to be robust and that we can start to see inflation go down, workforce. And then certainly I am a big supporter of the bipartisan infrastructure law, I think has been really beneficial and it was something that had been needed to be done for decades. And so continuing to advocate for whenever possible our federal government to direct funds directly to local communities to allow for the most flexibility of those investments. I think as much red tape as we can cut, it can really be beneficial to our communities and put taxpayer dollars back into our communities where they belong. So I don't, I'm one who doesn't vote in support of all of the resolutions. We certainly have some areas where I don't agree with things that people put forward. Mm-hmm. But overall, you know, the priorities of the conference around workforce, mental health, energy, homelessness, a lot of those things I do support. And I think that we're making some good progress on at a national level as well as a local level.
Again, Findlay Mayor Christina Mern from the U.S. Conference of Mayors annual meeting happening in Kansas City over the weekend. Mayor Mern, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks, Chris. Great to talk to you.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
And now an update of the odd and unusual side of the headlines. A mime who has entertained visitors at SeaWorld for 36 years has been let go after a dispute with a security guard at the park. Now, I'm not sure which SeaWorld location this is, whether it's in, I know there's one in Southern California, there's one in Orlando, and I think there are a couple of others still that are around, but in any event, it doesn't specifically say which location this is. But Lynn the Mime is his name. Lynn the Mime. He claims that he was scolded by a security guard because he was riding his bike around the park. But apparently he'd been doing this for many years. He'd been working there for 36 years. This is not the first time he's ridden his bike as part of his act. But apparently this security guard took exception to this. Unfortunately, he says he was terminated before given a chance to tell his bosses his side of the story. Lynn the Mime says the guard claimed that he threw his bike and swore at him. That the mime threw his bike and swore at him. Now, I'm having a hard time believing the security guard in this case, because he's a mime. Would he really be swearing? That would kind of bust the illusion, right? So I'm not sure that I buy all of this, but Lynn says that he didn't swear. He didn't use foul language. He goes on to say in his statement, "Everybody out there knows me and knows that I wouldn't do that." Lynn said he asked if he could come back and do one last show for visitors at SeaWorld, and they said no. Man, I'll tell you what. He has now launched a GoFundMe to support his new business venture, the Mime Company. So he's hoping that Lynn the Mime lands on his feet. You go to SeaWorld expecting to see Lynn the Mime. 36 years he was there at SeaWorld. No more. Elsewhere in the broken news, in one of the most bizarre cases of porch piracy ever, two robbers were caught on a home doorbell camera fighting for the same package. That is, you know that porch piracy has become a real problem when you've got the porch pirates fighting over who gets to steal the item off the doorstep. The video, and again, I'm not sure exactly where this comes from, was posted on social media and has gone viral here, shows two men racing each other to get the package before the driver even makes it back to his truck. After a brief tussle, one of the men makes off with the package, which the homeowner reveals just a pair of cell phones. The other would-be porch pirate eventually gives up and runs back to his car. The owner of the home who posted the video said, "Not really worried about the phones themselves, but what if this guy would have hurt, you know, one of his family members or something like that? Is this really what the world has come to?" The answer, yes, this is exactly what the world has come to. It's getting to the point where a guy can't make a dishonest living anymore. Man, let's see what else is going on. Speaking of viral videos, this has gone viral after originally, I guess, being published on the New York Post's website. Talk about getting burned on your wedding day. This is a big time the year for weddings, June weddings and all of that. I'm assuming this was in New York, is in the New York Post, but the bride and her beau walking down the aisle decorated with candles when the bride's dress caught fire. Apparently she got too close to a few of those candles on her way to the altar. Dress caught on fire. The whole thing caught on video. The bride, Bailey, said, "I am so relieved that no one was hurt. I can laugh about it now, but at the time, it was terrifying." Amazingly, the bride kept smiling through it all. We later find out that there happened to be several firefighters in the audience, as luck would have it. I don't know if she just knows a lot of firefighters or thought maybe something might go wrong. Maybe she had a premonition. But one way or the other, there were several firefighters in the audience, and they handled the situation. But it was wild, she said. I don't know if the wedding turned out to be hotter, or the wedding itself turned out to be hotter than the wedding night, but it certainly gave it a run for its money. Let's see. A couple of other items here in the broken news this morning. Apparently not content to do weird things in his own state, Florida man John Oliver has been arrested for allegedly throwing furniture off the 20th floor of a building in New York City. Apparently, Mr. Oliver got tired of just being a little fish in a big pond in Florida, where all kinds of people do dumb things, decided to go to Florida, or go to New York. Go big or go home, I guess. And he was throwing furniture off the 20th floor of a building in New York City. Happened on Friday in Midtown and was caught on camera by several shocked onlookers. Footage shows a chair, several pieces of wood and other debris flying through the air and striking the ground as bystanders scatter. The individual hurling debris cannot be seen in the video, but officers later identified him as John Oliver of Florida. They have not yet released a motive for these strange and potentially dangerous actions. Got bored doing dumb things in Florida. We got to go find someplace else to do dumb things at now, apparently. And finally, in the broken news this morning, and this is a great story. I mean, who doesn't love this? I mean, there's always, it's never too late to follow your dreams. How many times have we heard that old adage? That encouragement from people to never give up on their dreams is never too old. A 71-year-old woman from Texas is making history. Marissa Teo is now the oldest contestant to compete in the Miss Texas USA pageant. 71 years old. She's competing for the title of Miss Texas to represent the Lone Star State in the Miss USA pageant. The Miss Universe organization recently changed its rules and removed age limits for contestants over 18. They also allowed women who are married or divorced to participate. So it's not just single women, those who have been, it's previously it was single, never marrieds. Now you can be married, you can be divorced, and you can be any age. So Ms. Teo says she is excited to participate and hopes it will inspire other women to believe that there is beauty at any age. How awesome is that? 71 years old. I know who I'm rooting for. That is awesome. You go, girl. There you go. That is today's broken news report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Independence Day coming up next week. It is the big party of the summer. And if you are thinking of firing up the grill, you are not alone. 64.6% of Americans say the 4th of July is their favorite day of the year to barbecue. 64.6% of us say that is the best day of the year to cook out. This is according to a new survey of 4,000 Americans. In fact, the average respondent says that they are planning to grill 9 times or more over the course of the summer season. And we spend more than $90 each time we get the grill going. So you do the math, it's around $1,400 a year we spend grilling. 45% of those in the survey say that they throw a barbecue as an excuse to hang out with friends and family. Although 43% say that the only thing you need for to get that grill going, the only thing you need is a nice day. You don't need anything else. Just need a nice day. And that's the only excuse we need. And although we are a very divided country, most Americans agree that the ideal barbecue plate is a hamburger with ketchup, corn on the cob, and potato salad on the side. The quintessential 4th of July barbecue. We might have heard us talking about this last week. Like Memorial Day, the upcoming 4th of July week is expected to be one of record-setting travel. AAA says 70.9 million people are going to travel 50 miles or more from home over the Independence Day holiday travel period. And for the first time, AAA is looking at the entire week of July 4th, plus the Saturday before and the Sunday after. So that 4th of July travel week will run from this coming Saturday through Sunday after next. And 70.9 million travelers, they say, is a 5% increase compared to last year and an 8% increase over 2019, which was the year before the pandemic. So we have exceeded pre-pandemic levels. The senior vice president of AAA Travel says, with summer vacations in full swing and the flexibility of remote work, more Americans are taking extended trips, especially around Independence Day. We anticipate this July 4th week will be the busiest ever, with an additional 5.7 million people traveling as compared to 2019 before the pandemic. And that's AAA's official estimate. A lot of travel advisors would agree. They are booking billions of dollars of travel this year. The editorial team at Travel Age West, which is the premier magazine and online publication for industry professionals, reviews hundreds of travel suppliers and travel products and services each year to give out their WAVE awards to the best of the best in the business. And joining us this morning is travel industry expert and Travel Age West editor-in-chief Kenneth Shapiro with this year's winners. And Ken, what are the WAVE awards? What are the criteria? What goes into this, first of all?
Yeah, the WAVE Awards are really like the Oscars of the travel industry. Every year we ask travel advisors for their favorite picks for outstanding destinations, hotels, resorts, cruise lines, and more. This year we had more than 6,500 votes cast in 89 categories, which is a record for the 19-year history of the awards. We do a lot of extensive research in terms of coming up with the nominations for the awards, and then the travel advisors pick the winners.
And who are this season's top winners?
Well, this year, expedition cruising is actually really hot. These cruises, they go to exotic destinations such as Antarctica or the Galapagos or the Arctic. and they usually have an element of adventure associated with them. And big winners in that category included Silversea, which does a great job combining luxury with adventure, and Seabourn, which won for its new expedition ship, Seabourn Pursuit. In more mainstream cruising, Royal Caribbean won top awards, including Best New Ship for its Icon of the Seas. And Viking was a big winner across three different cruise categories, ocean cruising, expedition cruising, and river cruising.
So what are some of the other categories? You mentioned hotels and other things associated with travel. What are some of the other big winners this year?
Well, in the U.S., some of the classic top destinations are back, including New York, California, Florida, and Hawaii. Hawaii won this year as the top U.S. destination. Overseas, Japan is extremely popular this year, and it won for best destination in Asia. But overall, Europe is still the top destination, with favorites like Italy, France, and the UK leading the way. And it'll be interesting, actually, to see how the Paris Olympics, what that does to French tourism this summer.
Yeah.
So we'll be watching that for sure.
No, I was going to say, you know, people are always going to travel, but we hear stories that travelers are being more, shall we say, judicious with their budget this year in many cases. So talk a little bit about some of those trends. You mentioned some of the destinations, some of the top destinations. Where else are people going? How are they getting there? Where are they staying? Again, circle that back around with the award winners here.
Yeah, for sure. Well, in the all-inclusive category, Sandals was the big winner for that.
Okay.
In terms of luxury hotels, Ritz-Carlton was a big winner. And Marriott was overall for top U.S. hotel brand. But you're absolutely right. Budgets have so much to do with it. And we're seeing a trend of people using travel advisors because they want to make sure they're spending their money wisely and getting the kind of vacation they want. And that's the real art of planning a trip, is picking the place you want to go, the way you want to travel, the things you want to do that really fit your type of travel, your preferences, what you like to do. And travel advisors are just really great at that.
It is kind of interesting that the travel advisor, the travel agent, is making something of a comeback. For a while, it felt like DIY vacation planning was what most people did. You just click and book online. But like you said, one of the trends is that people are recognizing that travel advisors can be a valuable resource to tap into when you want to get, when you maximize your time, maximize your value, and so on.
Yes, absolutely. And with so many things that go wrong these days, we hear the headlines all the time. We're going to hear more this summer, unfortunately. You really need a travel advisor to watch your back, not just in the trip planning, but when you're on the trip, to make sure that everything goes smoothly and you have a great vacation. Same thing with travel insurance. You really need travel insurance these days because things go wrong. It's really complicated now to travel with flight cancellations and delays. The top winner at the Wave Awards for travel insurance was Allianz Travel Insurance. They do just a great job taking care of their customers. They've won for the last 8 or 9 years in a row, highest client satisfaction. I really think travel insurance is a must-have these days. I use it, and I tell everyone I know, you got to get travel insurance.
I always say, if nothing else, for the peace of mind. I mean, it's nice to know, even if nothing goes wrong, and certainly you hope nothing goes wrong, but you don't look at that as having, you know, paid for something you didn't use. You're paying for the peace of mind so that you don't have to worry about it and you can just relax on your vacation.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you're spending a lot on that vacation.
Right.
So it's really, you know, to safeguard that that investment is really worthwhile.
And, you know, the other thing, and again, to kind of toot the industry's horn here when we talk about travel advisors, that's really where one of the areas where having a travel advisor really shines, where you have someone, if something goes haywire, if something goes a little sideways, knowing that there's someone who's got your back and you're not on your own.
Yes, absolutely. If you've ever been in that situation, you know just how valuable it is to have somebody doing that, helping you out.
Again, Kenneth Shapiro is a travel industry expert and editor-in-chief of Travel Age West. We're talking about this year's Wave Awards. We mentioned some of the big winners. Where do we get more information, Ken?
Yeah, so you can get a full list of winners and coverage in the July 15th issue of Travel Age West and also at travelagewest.com.
Ken Shapiro, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it. Happy travels.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, and that is goodmornings.net. You can also connect with us on social media, sign up for our daily email newsletter. There's a link there to contact us directly via email if you want to do that, and much more. Again, goodmornings.net. We are always on 24/7 on the World Wide Web. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.